He worked on some of the most remarkable films of our generation. Everything from Real Genius to Napoleon Dynamite. Here he is, the man of the hour, John Grise. John, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, did you ever see my film called Young Studs in Long Leather?
Actually, I own three copies.
Yeah. That was
Why
hard
do you
to
own
find.
Three? You ran them out, huh? They're only on VHS. No, I'm kidding.
Well, John, great. It's great to have you on. Like we said before, big fans of Napoleon Dynamite, big fans of so many of the things that were that you've been in. One of the first times I've ever seen you was in Real Genius, one of my favorite films as a kid. And you know what? Your character lived in Val Kilmer's closet. So I got to ask you, around the same thing that you were saying before, how did it feel like, what did it feel like coming out of the closet?
You know, it was long overdue. No, it was fun, especially because, you know, I knew that it wasn't just hanging around smelling his clothes, you know. I actually got to go down into the steam tunnels and, you know, there was actually depth to the character. No pun intended.
What's it like working with Val? I mean, I've met Val on a couple of occasions and he's kind of eccentric, to say the least.
He's very eccentric. He's very he's quite intelligent, brilliant actually. He's got a brilliant mind, and he's a bit of a bon vivant sometimes, you know. He's like, but at the same time, he doesn't miss anything. As much as he might act like things go over his head or he doesn't hear or doesn't see, nothing really. And you know, he and I have done three films together, and I directed with him his screen test for The Doors. So we have a long relationship. You know, Real Genius was just the beginning, but then we worked quite a bit together after that, and or caused trouble together quite a bit. I can tell you stories about stuff that he did at 3 o'clock in the morning in front of Elvis's house, drunk out of his mind. But
that's what we want to hear.
Yeah, keep going.
We were driving across country. I guess he was coming back to do Top Gun. And we thought, let's go and check out Graceland. I was driving with him from New York back to L.A. And we got shit-housed, just drank ourselves into oblivion somewhere at some bar. And then we went to some crappy little motel in Memphis, and the dude said, "You, what are you both doing here? This, people of your color don't come to this motel." You know? And so we just decided we better leave, and then we went and picked up another six-pack of beer, and then at 7-Eleven and drove out to Graceland. And at that time, I guess it still hadn't been – it hadn't turned into the big business that Priscilla has turned it into. And, you know, there we were, and I had a video camera, and I videotaped him crying as he was urinating on the gate going, "The king is dead. The king is dead."
So basically what you're telling me is you can become a millionaire by selling that to TMZ right now.
No, he has the video, but the best part was the police came and they just shook us down and they were like, "What the hell are you guys doing here?" and blah blah blah, and you know, I couldn't believe it, but they didn't think we were drunk and they let us go. So
wow.
That's funny because he played Elvis in True Romance.
I know that was He was actually preparing for that. No, he was about to do.
I got a good drunk Val Kilmer story. He was doing a convention, and we were working at this convention in Jersey. It's called Chiller Theater. It's like an autograph convention with celebrities and whatnot. So he was there, and we both happened to be in the bathroom at the same time. I was pretty intoxicated. My friend was intoxicated right next to me. Val Kilmer's in between us taking a piss. So we're like, "Oh shit, it's Val Kilmer. Hey Val." She looked at
Val,
us.
"Val, show me your dick." No, go on.
Val goes up. Val just washes his hands, and it was that night there was a big Pacquiao fight that we're talking about it. So I go, "Hey Val, who do you think is gonna win the Pacquiao fight?" And he turns over to us, gives us the dirtiest look you could ever imagine, and says, "I don't talk to guys with dicks in their hands."
I agree with him.
He's got a good point.
Good point.
Yeah, that's my Val Kilmer story.
Well, at least, you know, he was honest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I respect the guy.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Well,
just total.
Just for Tombstone alone.
Yeah. Yeah, he's incredible. But you know, it's something I wanted to ask you about. We're talking about eccentric people. I had heard stories from different guests that we've had on the show. They had all different interactions with Daryl Hannah, and you work with her in Jackpot.
I worked with her in Jackpot, and I worked with her in The Big Empty.
And we're
friends. Yeah, she actually, The Big Empty, the character that I played, the actor who was going to play it. Long story, but it's kind of interesting. The actor dropped out of the film at the last minute, and she was the one who brought me up to play the character in The Big Empty with Jon Favreau and Kelsey Grammer and just a lot of people in that movie. And then, and I had quit acting at that time. You know, I've quit all the time. That's one of the reasons why I have this kind of checkerboard career. But I had quit, and I was writing for about a year, and the casting director called me. He said, come on out to the desert. We're shooting this movie. And I said, all right, what the fuck? And I went, and I did it. And then it was The Big Empty that actually led to me getting Napoleon Dynamite, because they were casting Napoleon Dynamite, you know, like 6 months later out of the office where they were editing The Big Empty. And the casting director was the same casting director. And when they couldn't figure out who they wanted for Uncle Rico, he showed them my footage from The Big Empty, and they said, let's make an offer. And that's funny. I tried to quit acting, but Daryl Hannah brought me back in. Okay, go ask me your question about Daryl Hannah.
No, I heard she's very eccentric. People have told us stories about her, and I just would love to know what it's like to work with her.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, she's really not that eccentric. I mean, you know, I think she might come from, you know, she might have a trust fund back there somewhere, but that kind of gives her a sense of entitlement, I imagine. But no, she's a little kooky, but all really fun and simple. I mean, you know, she will really get down and have a straight ahead conversation with you, look you in the eye. And I mean, if you guys are really having a deep one, she'll get there, you know. Don't mind that. It's a bird. I got a bird here in the kitchen.
The bird? Did you just choke it?
are you choking it?
You know how fucking some parrots, they learn certain things? This goddamn parrot, obviously at a very
early learned the rape
age,
whistle.
It learned the rape whistle. Yeah.
Are you in trouble, John?
Wait a minute. I got to get – oh, by the way, it was just hold on a second while I pull my dick out of its ass. Anyway, so
is Val Kilmer there?
You're planning on pissing on Graceland again?
Whoa. I'm eating peanuts. It must be that, you know. My guest gets on the radio and he sits there and eats. I just found a bag of, like, honey roasted peanuts. That's like Val Kilmer. He eats anything in sight, you know. Anyway.
Chronic munch.
Is that whistle again?
Johnny, okay?
No, I got to put the bird on my shoulder. She's really tight today. Anyway.
Well, you mentioned Napoleon Dynamite, one of my favorite films. I literally saw that in the movie theater 13 times because I'm retarded. But it's a film that's like no other. And a lot of people don't get the type of humor that film is. Either you love it or people don't understand it and they hate it. What was your first impression when you read that script?
Well, that, you know, thank God it was a good day, you know, because the script was so odd that I could have looked at it. If I was in a crappy mood, I might have said, what is this crap, you know? But but my manager called me and said, look, they've just offered you this movie. They want to pay you nothing. And I think you should just pass. I said, let me read this script. Why would I pass? I'll read it. I'll read everything. So by page 15, I was laughing out loud, and I called him back. I said, you tell him I'll be there. I'll do it. And so, you know, it was a good decision.
Was there a certain scene that you read and you're like, okay, that's it. That's funny. I'm doing this.
Oh, of course. When I threw the steak and hit him in the face, I was like, I got to do that too. I'm going to do that. You know,
what?
I played baseball for years. I'm going to throw that steak.
Did you actually hit him really hard with it?
Oh, I did. I hit him so hard with the steak that it knocked his glasses off and gave him a bruise for the rest of the movie.
Nice.
And, you know, the first, like, three times I threw the steak, I tried to, like, lead him. So I tried to toss it lightly so it would kind of bounce off his face. And, you know, Jared Hess, we were shooting on film. He did not have that much film left. And he was like, maybe we should just move the camera in and just hit him close up. And I said, if you hit him close up, you'll kill the joke. It won't be funny. You got to keep the camera where you got it. I can hit him, but I got to really chuck the steak. And no pun. And John Heater was like, so chuck it. Go on. So I did. I mean, I just hauled back, and it was a big piece of meat, and I threw it hard, and oh, they didn't have to put any sound. I mean, it slapped him so hard in the face. If you really look at it, you can see Pedro is almost, he has to get out of that frame because he is about to lose his shit. He's about to laugh so hard.
The way you're talking about slapping meat against someone's face, it kind of goes back to your intro.
It's
about
like my
that film that you did
last night.
No. Like your girlfriend. How come we don't hear about you dating famous celebrities?
Oh, you know, I have actually, but I don't like actresses.
Why not?
So I don't date famous actresses because they're so fucking neurotic, you know.
It's true.
I just like to date pretty girls. You know, and I've been lucky. You know, I've been fortunate.
Who was the most famous person you ever dated?
Most famous person I ever dated. I mean, don't mind that sound. That's the bird scratching its beak. Now he's on my shorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm rubbing one out as I'm talking. Yeah.
Did you say you were eating peanut butter?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just slapping that on her. I don't know. I mean, the famous girl that I dated, I don't know. I mean, you know, Toni Welsh, I guess, way back in the day.
Oh.
Raquel Welch's daughter. She was in Cocoon.
Oh, yeah. Now you got me. I just had to think of her naked.
Yeah, exactly. The only way I could remember her.
Yeah, her mom still looks good.
Oh, yeah, she does.
Does she?
Oh, yeah, still. She's amazing.
Gosh. Well, you see, it's she probably does, too. I mean, she's a beautiful woman. Very, very sweet. You know, really, I'm joking when I say beautiful woman. I just like that. As long as they got good character. I like smart girls, I must say. I don't like dingbats, you know.
Would you date a fat chick?
Well, it depends.
On?
On how fat.
Let's
like
talk,
if
like...
it's super fat so that the smell is a little odd, I can't handle it.
You get a little of that stench.
I worked in a play with a girl, and she was overweight, a woman. It was a Shakespearean play, and every time I walked by her, I was like, I really almost lost my shit every time I walked by her. And so I was like, yeah, you know, I think that's got to be the cutoff right about there. If she's any that size or bigger, it's no go. And it just kind of turned me off to women of size.
But before that, you ever go hogging though? Was there that one night at the bar?
I did, sure. I had a couple of good hefty women in my time. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. I never went down that route.
Put it this way, it was for the experience. And my brother, when he saw that I was going home with this girl, he said, "Wait, hold on, John, what are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean? I'm going home with her." He goes, "You need help." That's what my brother said.
Well, you won the Teen Choice Award for Napoleon Dynamite for the biggest sleaze bag. Where do you keep it? Where's that biggest sleaze bag award? Like, that would be on my mantle if I had that.
You know what? I'll tell you what. You know who's got it and who has everything, and they should just, you know, shoot themselves in the face? Is Fox. They probably kept everything, you know.
Wow, really?
Oh yeah, they kept everything. They kept everything. I mean, what? You know, I don't even think it wasn't me that collected that award. It was Roger down in accounting. I mean, I don't know.
Well, what the hell happened with that Napoleon Dynamite cartoon? I mean, we were such a big fan. Yeah, it was a TV show, cartoon TV show, but we loved the film so much. We're like, okay, maybe they'll do a sequel because of the popularity of it, especially when MTV started having Napoleon and Pedro on their commercials. And you get a cartoon.
Yeah, well, we were doing the cartoon. You know, there's all kinds of stories, you know, truth be told. There's all kinds of stories. There was a little bit of litigation, and I'm not saying anything, but I know that there was... there was an audit and there was a lot of money found that had not been apparently or allegedly paid. And all of a sudden, when I think the olive branch was going to be the cartoon, because right after the cartoon had been ordered, then all of a sudden there was talk of settlement, and the producers just flat out said, no, we're not settling. We're going to court. And then after six episodes, cartoon gone. So I think that really you're getting a real, real story. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So when you talk about money is being owed, is it to Jared and his company,
To the producers, to the people that funded the independent financiers who financed Napoleon Dynamite to the tune of $300,000+,
Well,
and they had a percentage of that movie. And this is all alleged. You know, this is like tales out of school. I don't know the real inside dope. I'm just telling you the rumors. You know, there were rumors this way and rumors that way. And one of the darkest of the rumors was that the cartoon was kind of a way to extend an olive branch. But you can't do it if you only order six episodes. If they'd come back and ordered 22, I imagine everything would have been fine.
So there was only a six episodes that were ordered. So that's all you shot. What we saw is what you did.
That's right. They ordered 13 episodes, but they split us between what the heck's his name? You know, babysitter, funny kid, the chubby kid. He had a cartoon, too.
Oh, Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill. He's so funny. His cartoon and our cartoon, they did seven of his and six of ours, and that was it. We were like, we were competing for a spot, and neither of us apparently made it, so.
Wow. So, like you said, that Napoleon Dynamite was made for, like, $300,000. Once it becomes this mega hit on DVD and Blu-ray, and all of a sudden the merchandising that goes into that, I mean, your face was on everything from T-shirts to buttons to crazy things. First off, what was the craziest thing you saw your face on? And second off, did you get paid for that?
There'd be like a every 6 months a check would come from Fox for the merchandising, and I think the biggest one I ever got was $20.
Are you serious? $20?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Yeah, so...
Holy shit.
Yeah, you know, it's just the way it is. You know, the mothership owns everything, so that's how it happens. It's part of the game, you know.
It's part of the deal.
I mean, I never expected to get anything from merchandising, so I think the people that represented me at that point were not savvy enough to look into that aspect of the deal, like thinking ahead, wow, what if this happens? What if that happens? You know, you get good lawyers and good agents, and they think those things out ahead of time. But, you know, you get with people that, you know, thankfully the people I'm with now are a lot more savvy. But back then I was not with the sharpest knife in the drawer, let's just say. And
wow.
So, yeah. So I never really took it, you know, it's like I took it all with a grain of salt. It was like, okay, you know, I get what happened. My father was a filmmaker, you know. I remember he directed a film called Breakout with Charles Bronson, of which he had a big piece of it. And he would put the posters on the window, on the wall saying, number one grossing film in America, 3 weeks running, you know, and he never received a dime. So, I mean, I knew... And that was Warner Brothers. I had a heads up on how the game kind of is run. So I didn't really have any huge aspirations to, you know, looting the coffers of Fox. I mean, I know that they're the ones that got to keep the machine alive and breathing. So they got to protect that money.
Wow.
Did you meet Charles Bronson?
I did. I hung out with Charles Bronson. Yeah, I did a couple of times. My father directed two films with him. He directed Breakout and Break Hard Pass, all with the same, yeah. But at the time, before I was bald, I had long, long hair, and I was a kid, you know. And Bronson used to always say, "You got to cut your hair. You need to cut your hair." And one day, I never forget. My father died when I was 19, and I was walking through some store, and some guy from behind me says, "Hey, you cut your hair." I turned around, it was Bronson. Out of the blue, I hadn't seen him in 5 years, but he remembered. He was really sweet.
Wow.
That's a real man's man.
Oh, yeah. Real good guy. Real straightforward.
Well, seeing that you grew up kind of like in the business, that's pretty much all you know. Do you feel like you had the quote-unquote normal childhood?
No. No, I mean, you know, because we moved so much when I was a kid. I mean, I think by the time I was in fifth grade, I'd been to six schools, you know.
Wow,
so gypsies.
It's a little hard. You know, it's a little hard to get yourself established when you know, in any sense of, you know, just friends and stuff. You know, you felt like a military kid or something.
Yeah. Well, there's so many films that you've been a part of, and I remember I grew up in a block before there was Blockbuster Video. My uncle owned a bunch of independent video stores when I was a kid, so like early 80s, right when that boom hit, like 83, 84, he had these stores, and I could sit there and I could tell you what the box looked like for every film, and there's certain boxes that stand out in my mind from like the 80s and the 90s, and one of them was Rainbow Drive. I remember seeing that box, being at that video store, and I especially remember the tagline, which we don't see taglines that much anymore, which killed me because I loved it. It was, "He's the right cop on the wrong road. It's a dead end."
It's terrible.
Was that the best / worst tagline of a film that you've ever worked on?
Oh, yeah. It was fun, you know. I don't even really remember doing that movie, you know? I mean, I don't. I remember working with Peter Weller a little bit, but, you know, just a couple of – I didn't remember it, you know? It seemed like every time I show up, they just say, okay, here's where we are. We're doing this thing now, and you're going to do this. And I said, you mean the same thing that was in the script? And they'd say, well, yeah, but a little different, you know, whatever.
Whatever
Peter wants.
One film that you worked on, that's got to be a different experience. We've had this guy on the show before, Charles Band from Full Moon Pictures. Very, very different human being. Fun guy.
Yeah.
But I know that anyone who works on his sets always say it's a completely different experience. And you were in Terrorvision.
Yeah. We shot that in Italy.
He shoots a lot of his stuff in Europe, is what
he
told us.
I mean, back then it was so cheap for him. And he had the right idea. He was making, he did Scanners, and he did, what's the H.P. Lovecraft story where the guy's head blows up? What's that? Is that Scanners? No.
That's Scanners,
What the hell is that movie? He did that one there. He did Crawl Space there with Kinski. And, you know, I remember all his whole lineup of films because it was like kind of a family, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of – that was amazing. That was incredible, you know, because you're shooting this kind of low budget, not realizing it's going to become kind of a horror cult film. You think it's just going to be a big piece of garbage, but you're so happy to be in Italy feeling like, you know, you feel like you're – you know, in your mind you're doing Fellini, but, you know, you're just kind of living Fellini. But.
Well, in that film you were dating Diane Franklin, who we had on the show, and
– Uh-huh.
She's one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my entire life.
Such a sweet, sweet girl, too.
Yeah.
We just did the commentary for Terrorvision. We just watched it and did the commentary with Ted Niccolo, the director.
Really?
The first time I've seen the movie since the movie was out, you know. Once in a while, my buddies at the Alamo Draft House will, in down in Texas, they'll screen it or screen Jackpot or Real Genius, and they'll have me down and have a big, you know, hoop-de-doo. But I didn't stick around for Terrorvision for whatever reason. I had to go eat or something. But, yeah, it's just the first time I've seen it. You know,
well, she still looks gorgeous. I mean...
Oh, she does, yeah. Yeah, you know, she doesn't change.
That would be the point of working on that movie, is trying to hit on her and getting her. Jesus Christ,
but
she's gorgeous.
But you have to know that she was such a good girl. You know, like, I couldn't even look at her like that.
Well, as good as she is, she looked better in my bed.
Well, you know something? Later on when we talked about, when we were shooting Terrorvision, I never had sex with her. And I would say, you know, I always thought you were so cute, but I always thought you were such a goody-goody, and I just was afraid to, like, cross the line with you. And she was like, are you kidding? I'm horny. You know, it's like, now you tell me. It's like, she goes, oh, my God. I was like, you know, that was crazy.
You didn't work hard enough.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, well, there you go, man. It's
lazy.
We got a bunch of good email questions that I want to put past you. John Travolta, you work with him and Get Shorty. Did John Travolta ever ask you for a massage?
Matter of fact, he once walked up to me from behind and started massaging my shoulders.
You ever get that vibe from him?
Oh, what? That he wanted to play Hide the Salami?
Yeah.
No. No. You know something?
Not when he was running his fingers through your hair.
I just thought he was like a. This is the honest to God's truth, and I'm certainly not. I'm not going to. You know, I've been very straightforward with you guys. I'm not lying. I never got that vibe from him, but I did get the vibe that John just kind of, he just dances to his own tune, and whatever that is. And I don't think that it, you know, we kind of will look at something and go, well, what's his sexual orientation? But I don't know if that even, if it qualifies under that. You know, it's like, I think he just always seems kind of happy and in his own world all the time. He really does, you know. So it would be easy to say, yeah, this guy's, you know, he's having fun with little Asian boys. But I don't know.
So you never saw him, like, tiptoeing through the tulips or skipping around?
Oh, no. He was always having just a good time. He was always laughing and joking. And, you know, he was really sweet to everybody. Great guy. Really wonderful guy.
What about Hackman? Talented.
Hackman kind of kept to himself. You felt like Hackman was like, am I really going to do this again? I'd heard that he was trying to retire, and his manager kept getting jobs for him. And finally, he said, that's enough. Enough is enough. But he had been trying to retire for 10 years, and his managers just kind of kept getting him these huge paydays. And he's like, you just got to do this, you know.
That's a good scene with you, Hackman, and Dennis Farina.
And Delroy Lindo. Oh, no, yeah, that's right, yeah, and that one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the part where, you know what I'm talking about.
Put a bull in the pro. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Who is the biggest dick you ever worked with?
Oh, let me see. I don't know, you know, like, I don't know if there's, you know, I worked with Robert Blake when I was a kid, and I was like one of the first jobs I got, I did an episode of Beretta.
Nice.
And I was playing a retarded kid. And I was in a room full of retarded, really, I mean, okay, let me say challenged children, challenged kids. I don't know why the R word gets so, you know, it just means a little, you know, like the race, just three steps behind, big deal.
Yeah.
But he came in and he was just like, you know, everybody was standing around waiting, and all of a sudden he walks on the set, and I'm like, oh, God, I don't want to work with this guy. And he's like, he looks at me, he goes, just don't say anything. He starts talking, and then finally he looks at me, like, asks me some question that's not in the script. I'm too young. I'm like, am I supposed to say my line, or am I supposed to, you know, I got, you know, and he was like, oh, God, kid, shit. Yes, you know, he was all upset about it. And, you know, I was like, I was too young. I was so green, and I was so freaked out, you know. It scared me.
Did he look like a murderer?
Yeah.
Even back then?
Yeah, both him and William Shatner. Nobody knows that Shatner kept his foot on his wife's head. She was trying to get out of the pool.
That's what I heard.
I don't know.
Another bombshell.
You heard it first here. I just want you to know.
Here, I want to know what your answer is to this. I think this would be a bombshell. We play a game called Fuck, Marry, Kill. You have to fuck one, you have to marry one, you have to kill one. Napoleon Dynamite Edition. Grandma, LaFonda, and Tina.
Oh, wow. Fuck Grandma.
Nice.
Yeah, sometimes a little age is good. Marry LaFonda, and I'll kill Tina. No, I don't know. I can't play this game. I take it too seriously.
It's a serious game.
No joke.
I know. I like them all. That's the problem. And I don't like to kill animals, you know.
So what do you do with you and meat? Everyone, it's all over the internet. Do you eat meat? Do you not eat meat? Who gives a shit, first of all? And do you eat meat?
I eat meat. Yeah, I always did. I just didn't want to eat. Look at that steak. You saw the steak in that movie. I mean, you know, they kept letting it get cool and flies would land on it, and then they'd put it back in the microwave and heat it up and flies land. You know, it's like, I'm not gonna swallow this shit. There's no way.
Well, someone actually wrote in to talk about Martin, how you were the token white guy on Martin.
That's exactly how I described myself on that show.
People want to know, did you ever feel like that white guy in the middle of Harlem while working in Martin?
Well, you know, I would say that, interestingly enough, the people that were the most difficult on that show were the white producers, writers, who didn't give a crap about developing anybody's character. They were only worried about what made Martin happy. So, interestingly enough, you know, I got along with everybody in the cast and enjoyed everybody in the cast. And the people that drove me crazy were the kind of, you know, the smiling and shaking your hand white / writer producers. And you know, you're trying to develop a character, and they just, you know, like Sisyphus, the rock just keeps rolling back down the hill because they don't give a shit. And yet you're a character and you're integral to the story, but they don't care. They don't give a shit. So they don't write for you. And then their directions to me were like, that line, if you need to change that line a little bit, change it. Just make it funny. You know, meanwhile, they were like tearing their hair out, writing everybody else's dialogue to perfection. And, you know, the white guy got kind of dissed by the white guys.
So it was prejudice. You got prejudice from the white guy on the black hair.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Exactly.
Wow. What did you do for Black History Month? What did you do to celebrate?
I took Garrett Morris out for lunch.
Wow. Now that guy must have some stories.
He's amazing.
Who's your most famous friend?
Garrett Morris.
What's it like to hang out with Garrett Morris?
It's amazing. He's just, you know, he's so real. Such a good dude. No, I mean, I guess Val Kilmer's more famous, but...
No, not to me.
Garrett Morris, man.
Does he just, like, come over and you play with the parrot, eat some peanuts? Like, what do you guys do when you hang out?
Yeah, we'll go to Roscoe's and get some chicken and waffles, and I'm not kidding you. Or we'll just hang out, you know, and I have a recording studio, and he'll come over and want to play the piano or something, and we'll hang out back there, you know. Just a good guy. He can sing, and he can play, too. He can write songs.
I don't understand. Why have we not seen this album yet? I heard a long time ago that you're an amazing guitarist, that you're going to produce an album. It's going to be out there for us to listen to, and I haven't heard anything since. What happened?
I directed a film called Pickin' and Grinnin', of which I scored, too, even though I scored it under a pseudonym. I have a pseudonym for scoring the film because there was a lot of other people that played on it, so I really wanted to create it like, oh, it's a band. We are a band, even though we weren't really a band. We were just all putting different, you know, musical stings and stuff. But I did most, the bulk of it. And that kind of derailed all, you know, of the music stuff that I was doing. And quite honestly, the project has truly been sitting on a shelf for too long. And I just, Justin Stanley, who was producing it with me, who now, you know, he's moved on ahead. He's producing Eric Clapton now. So, you know, it's like, we got a moment. Would we go back and kind of tinker around with those songs that we were doing? You know, so it's just a question of the timing being right. And if I am waiting for him, or I'll just go ahead and do it myself, you know, one of those things.
Well, I'm dying to hear what it sounds like. And I heard a quote from you that you're a closet metal fan.
Yeah, I am.
Favorite metal band?
Yeah, you know. I like, you know, I mean, I like some of the really, you know, I don't like the new ones where the guys just sing like they're vomiting, you know. I hate that, you know. I could do that. It's too easy. They can't, you know. But I did like Megadeth. I thought they were pretty amazing. And, you know, I like some of the, you know, I even like some of the hair bands like Cinderella and Wasp.
Nice.
And, yeah, man. Scorpions. You know.
All right. You got some street cred.
Yeah. But, you know, but and also my guitar playing, I could never play. The reason I like all those bands is I could never play in one of those bands because those guys are ridiculous.
Yeah.
They're ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I could sit around and play, like, you know, in Neil Young's backup band, you know. But, you know, you give me, you know, that kind of progression, I can get through, you know. I'm not an incredible musician. I'm a jack of all trades, master of none.
Well, we got a couple more questions here. We got Todd from Texas wanted to know, is Billy Crystal really a douche?
The answer for that would be, to me, he was.
Was he really?
No, he wasn't really. He just wasn't. I don't know. He was really nice in the beginning when we were working together. And then, I don't know, maybe he was unhappy. Maybe things were going on that he just, like, you know, I was a young kid, so I didn't know, you know, and not that young, but I was like, look, I thought if a guy's nice to you, the guy's nice. And then you start talking to him and all of a sudden, you know, he wavered, you know, not unlike Martin Lawrence, you know, some days in great moods, wonderful guys, and then other days, not necessarily, you know, got a lot of stuff on their minds, so you can't take it personally, you know. I really think that Billy Crystal's hugely funny, and I think he's a good guy. Let me put it this way, 80% of the time he was really nice to me, 20% of the time, you know, he probably had stuff on his mind.
Well, what's the douchiest thing that he did? Is there something that sticks out in your mind?
Well, as a matter of fact, you know, I don't want to say.
Oh, come on. You can't leave us hanging like that.
Tell me Gregory Hines was cool.
He was amazing.
Of course.
Let's go back to that douche thing. I'm dying to know what it is. There's got to be one thing that he really sticks in your mind.
It's a long story, and it's too much. I was playing catch with a guy named Jim McAveedy. And we were on what is now the Sony lot, used to be the MGM lot when we were shooting Running Scared. We're probably in the last week of shooting all the interiors, and then we were going to go to Chicago. They were going to go to Florida first for 2 weeks, and then we were going to meet them in Chicago 2 weeks after that, you know, I mean 2 weeks later, and then spend the rest 6 weeks in Chicago and shoot the rest of the movie. And I was playing – Jim McAveedy was a AAA shortstop for the Minnesota Twins, and the only reason he did not – get called up was because Gene Mock was the manager and his nephew was the shortstop, and I'm not going to name his nephew. I don't want to call him out, but he, you know, I played baseball in college, and Jim and I were throwing the baseball and out on the street, and I'd heard that, I mean, you know, in the lot, and it was lunchtime, and I heard that Billy was a baseball player, and as he was walking up, if I tossed this ball to like a little four-year-old kid, that's how I tossed it to him. Like, here, catch, you know. And it hit him in the hand, and he went ballistic. He was like, ow, oh my God, ow. And they had to run him off to the infirmary. And Peter Himes came up to me and said, what are you throwing baseballs at my lead actor for? And, of course, thankfully, Jim McAveedy, who saw the whole thing, just looked at me, and he was like, don't worry about it. You know, kind of behind Peter Himes' back, just don't worry, it's all cool. And then, of course, Peter Himes laughed it off. Now, here's the interesting end of the story. We had to do a scene later that night where Stephen Bauer and I both get punched by Billy and Gregory, and somebody moved a table. And so I'm supposed to get hit and spin around and land on the table, but the table wasn't there. And so I get hit, I spin around, and I land my eyebrow on what is where the table's edge, you know, because it was too far away. I was supposed to land on it and roll off it, you know, and somebody had moved it. And so I needed stitches. I was bleeding like crazy out of my eye. And this was the last night of shooting before they were going to Miami the following day. And Peter Himes came to me and said, do you want to go get a stitch or can we finish the day of shooting? I said, no, we'll finish the day of shooting. And they closed up my eye with a butterfly stitch and then put a bunch of mortician's wax on it. And it looked like, I looked like Frankenstein. And I kept saying, people are going to notice this. And he said, trust me, there's so much smoke on the set, nobody will know. Because he had smoke always on his head, right? And, you know, it was like, here I'd done this, and Billy Crystal had, you know, gone to the infirmary earlier that day from getting hit in the hand with a baseball. It was kind of ironic that this kind of had happened all in the
wow.
same day. So.
Wow.
So that was kind of it.
Well, that's a little controversial, but something else controversial that happened. We talked about Martin before. I don't even know why this slipped my mind. Martin Lawrence and Tisha Campbell, the stars. I don't know if you were still on the show when...
No, I only was there for 2 years. I was there while it was still, you know...
normal?
Still good. Yeah. And then it went... I heard it haywire, yeah. Garrett and I were only there for 2 years, yeah.
There was some kind of allegations of sexual assault, and she wasn't in any scenes with him if she came back, so it's wacky.
Did they kill your character off on Martin?
No, they just moved out of the radio station into a TV station.
Little reverse racism.
Listen, I was calling my agents every day saying, please get me off this show. I truly was. I was saying, I'm going to kill myself if I'm here for another year. I had to get out of there.
Was it the worst job you ever had in the business?
Yeah, probably one of them. Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm not going to – thankfully, it paid for me to buy a house, you know. And, you know, I wasn't paid super well like a lot of these people, but it was enough that, you know, listen, it was better than working for UPS or something, right?
Yeah, true. Or by selling Bust Must, which actually leads to my next question. Someone wanted to know, if you could give Bust Must to any celebrity, who would it be?
I wouldn't, maybe a couple of those, RuPaul, how about that?
Good answer. We don't mind, we're going to take a couple phone calls real quick before I let you go. I appreciate you staying on this long. It's a great interview. We got calls from all over the world. We got Paul from Australia. Paul, you're on the line.
Australia?
Yes, thank you so much, Manny. It's a great privilege to talk to you, John Grant. It's a great privilege.
How you doing, Paul?
What would be your most... Oh, great, thanks, John. I'm great, thanks. What would be your most favorite memorable moment on any project that you've ever worked with? Thank you, Patty.
Of who? Say that again, of who I ever worked with? Or what was that, of any actor or of who? Hello?
Yes, with an actor.
I would say one of the best was, you know, sometimes the best moments is when the film is done because they're too emotionally draining. I did a drama called Around June, and the day the film was done, I was glad because I was working with Samira Armstrong, and she threw something at me and hit me in the leg with it. I was happy that was over. I was happy when I hit Napoleon with the stake. That was a glory moment. Some of my best acting is when I'm doing stuff like that.
Well, I was happy when you hit Billy Crystal with the ball.
if I'd thrown it any lighter, you know. Oh, poor guy.
We got Gerard from Florida. Gerard, you're on the line.
What's up, Gerard?
Yeah, what's up, man? Yeah, I was just wondering if you think Angelina from the Jersey Shore has nards like the Wolfman.
You know, I'm not going to say anything about anybody from the Jersey Shore because I don't want to get killed. I'll end up in a block of cement. they're all, from what I understand, all their parents are mob. So, Gerard, you better change your phone number.
All right, we got Chris.
Don't do that. He's already paranoid.
we got Chris from Maryland. Chris, you're on the line.
Hey, John, great interview, man. You've exposed some secrets. As a matter of fact, Grandma just called. She said you should go home because you're ruining everyone's lives and eating all their steak.
Well, that's good. You mean, as long as I'm not taking up their space. What's your question, though?
Yeah, Chris, you got a question?
How long did it take you to grow that goatee?
the one I'm wearing now or the one that surrounds my balls and penis?
The one that you wore when you was going down on Daryl Hannah.
I don't. Listen, this is getting out of control. You know, Chris, good luck. The Orioles might have a chance this year.
So where can we see you next, John? I know you're working like crazy. You've got like your IMDb.
I know.
Your IMDb.
I know IMDb. Gosh.
There's so many things on there. When's the next thing we could see you in?
Well, I just I finished an untitled film, and I don't know what the title is going to be, but I think it's going to be an amazing film. And I previous to that, I did another film called The Well. And these two films will be coming out. There's another film called Option Arm. These are all independent films, but quite amazing scripts. Really, really good scripts. And, you know, I don't know. I have a Twitter thing. That's the only thing I do is, you know, my name, John Grise, at John Grise, or whatever that is, at Twitter. So sometimes I'll write what I'm up to down there, and, you know, people want to go check it out, go check it out. But that's it. I just literally finished shooting 2 days, 3 days ago on this other film. And then, you know, so now I'm just enjoying not working.
Some free time, hanging out with the parrots, eating the peanuts.
The parrot, my dogs, my girlfriends, my friends. You know, it's nice to...
Girlfriends.
You know, I have a few friends. It gets so... And I'm also, you know, I'm producing a record for this girl named Alaska Reed. And she's an amazing musician, and I have a studio, and so she's here, and I'm working with her. And, you know, right now we're just I work. By the way, there's a great group from Texas called the Quaker City Nighthawks that they mixed the record here, and I took the photograph for the album sleeve, you know. And you know, I do a lot of, like I said, I do a lot of different things, so I'm always up to something.
Awesome. Well, maybe we can do a song together. I'm thinking of a song
Let's
right now. Maybe we can title it Daryl Hannah's Vag.
Well, I just want to know. And then you'd hear, I just want to know. Exactly where I'm supposed to go.
Well, sorry. John, no, great interview, man. Thank you so much for joining us.
I think I'm going to get sued from this interview. I just want you to know. Yeah.
Well, we love you, so anytime you want to come back on, you just let us know. Big fans,
okay.
Bigger fans now that we have this interview. Thank you so much, John Grise.
All right. Take care, you guys.
Take care, John.
Take care.
Stay out of trouble.
John Grise, yeah.